Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be starting with health and nutrition. We're going to talk about eating late at night and how that wreaks havoc upon your body. New research from the University of Pennsylvania. And how new findings and research show that colitis can be improved with pomegranate, polyphenix, from Texas A&M University. And also, four things that we could do to substantially prevent disease and extend our lifespan from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and a whole lot more on health and healing, including, do the mammograms really help us? And this is Orthodox Medicine who's giving us this question. Also today from our environmental segment, I'm going to read a report from Andrea Vilcek from Counterpunch. It's entitled, Indonesian Borneo is Finished. They also sell orangutans into sex slavery. Impossible to imagine all this going on and how one of the largest islands in the world, one of the three largest islands, is completely destroyed. How could this happen? How could we not know about it? Was it hidden? Was it denied? Well, I'm going to take you on this tour to show you what's happening around the world. Now, why? Why is it important for you to know what's going on in Borneo? Well, it's just as important for you to know what's going on in North Dakota, where a farmer walks outside, and for the first time in his life, this farmer also happens to be a forest ranger and a scientist, his wife, who was outside, said, you got to see this. And he sees a dust storm. They had never had a dust storm in North Dakota before, and here's a huge dust storm. Where'd it come from? Well, it's also important you know about that, even though you're not in North Dakota and you don't see that happening, because it's all related to how we're treating the earth, how we're using all of its resources in ways that cannot be replenished. We would need two planets to honor our current desires for a always higher and more extravagant standard of living. In fact, last night when I was walking back from a film, I stopped into a new restaurant. And I looked at the menu because I'd heard about it. And it was filled with young people. In fact, I didn't see anyone that I consider not a millennial, people in their 20s and 30s. And probably people who are well-educated and successful in their careers. And I looked at the menu. Now, mind you, this was at 10 o'clock last night, and that means there had already been two seatings, and there'd probably be another seating after that. Four seatings in that holds 100 seats is a lot of people. So by any measure, it's successful. Good for them. But then I looked at their menu, and I see half pig head, but of course they had some coconut rice and some kimchi to it, and it's $80. Or day-dry aged tomahawk meat, which is a bone marrow based, and it's $125. And all these other dishes, which I'm sure are prepared well to the taste of people, but not realizing, where does that meat come from? What does it go through? What role does it play in the environment and causing those dust storms or causing the destruction of Borneo? So you have to begin to pull back far enough and look at everything in life as a piece of a puzzle. And today, we're going to look at just one piece of that puzzle. I'll also play another clip. Yesterday, I had on the founder of the Weather Channel, and, you know, saying that he has science on his side, and immediately after that, I challenged that by offering over 40 current, right now as of today, current scientific evaluations, major institutions across the world in the United States, showing global warming is not only real, but devastating and destroying species and the planet. And today I will continue. Today I'm going to list some of the organizations that are engaged in what I would consider, my own personal opinion from my own scholarship and research, global denialism. And some of them are going to be surprising to you because they're probably ones that you think are very green and therefore very good. Well, there are good green organizations. I'm going to mention them also. But I'm going to tell you who's funding many of these foundations and these environmental groups, because where the money comes from frequently dictates what they will or will not investigate. But next week, I'm going to do a 1 to 2 hour special on Tuesday evening showing you the best places, the worst places to live, based upon the most current information we have on what's happening to our environment, and give you the problems as I see them and the solutions that are possible. So we're going to take a look at Borneo today as part of our environmental discussion, and the guest in the second part of our program is Professor Gershon Shafir. He is a professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of California, and he is the author of 7 books that are important to our knowing what's going on in the world. His latest one is A Half Century of Occupation, Israel-Palestine, the World's Most Intractable Conflict. Why? Because this week is the 50th anniversary of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since the Six-Day War. So I wanted someone who was a scholar, someone who had written extensively on the subject, someone who was not approaching it based upon an ideology or political reference. And so we have, I consider, one of the best minds in America to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let's begin. A lot of people eat late at night. It's now found that a lot of younger people eat late at night because they're staying up later. They think nothing of having a dinner at 11 o'clock at night, depending upon where you live. If you're in college, sometimes people are eating at 1 o'clock in the morning. Even if you have a snack, your body starts to go into an anabolic state. It means it's like you get in your car, you sit down, and you turn on the engine, you start revving the engine. That's what fuel does to your system, no matter what hour of the day it is. But there's a time where we want to turn off the engine and let the body go through a catabolic breakdown, cleansing, detoxification state. That generally starts around 9 o'clock at night. That's why many of us eat earlier. I generally eat one major meal a day. I'll snack and graze throughout the day, an apple here, a juice there, a small salad, something simple. Grazing restricts the caloric intake, gives you the type of food your body can digest quickly and easily, doesn't overtax the digestive system or the stomach, so you always feel light. You don't feel heavy, bloated. You don't feel as if you have to sit down after a meal. You're tired because you've eaten so many carbs that your blood sugar is spiking. So when you eat is important. So here's what the University of Pennsylvania has to say about this. They're saying that eating late at night could be worse for your health than you think. Why? Because compared to eating earlier in the day, prolonged delayed eating can increase weight gain, increase insulin, therefore your diabetic conditions can worsen, or your pre-diabetic conditions can become diabetic, and it can increase the bad cholesterol levels. And it also negatively affects your fat metabolism, and it will negatively affect your hormonal markers, which are implicated in heart disease and diabetes. So that's a whole lot of bad, including life-ending and life-changing conditions, just by eating late at night. The findings offer the first experimental evidence on the metabolic consequences of delayed eating compared to daytime eating. You're much better off having a really highly nutritious breakfast. Now today, for example, I came in and I got my bowl out, and when people look at it, they say, looks like mud. Yeah, it does, because of all the dark pigments from all of the high quality polyphenols I put into it. I won't tell you what goes into mine, because my needs and what I do for my body to slow down and reverse the aging process are going to be different than other people. And just like you wouldn't walk in and order 16 ounces of wheatgrass and 3 ounces of ginger juice and 2 ounces of lemon juice and a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, you would projectile vomit like you were out of The Exorcist. But But I do that each day. It's just one of 10 juices I have. So each of us has to evolve through a process of cleansing and detoxifying and enhancing our metabolism based upon the energy we're expending. So anyhow, when I'm preparing my breakfast, that's the most important meal of the day. And I choose to do it by blending all different types of important nutrient compounds, either liquids as an intensive amount of pomegranate from a pomegranate liquid concentrate. And what that means is that when they juice the pomegranate, they evaporate probably one-third and sometimes one-half the liquid. So therefore, when you're taking it, you're really taking a whole lot of pomegranate. And then same thing with mulberry, which is very important, and which people generally don't think ever about having as a juice, but it's really good, very powerful. So anyway, I take all told maybe 30 different fruits and vegetables into this one blend, and it looks like I'm making a bread dough. I'm stirring it, and adding different, like tart cherry concentrate and papaya concentrate. Actually, it tastes pretty good. And so that's giving me as much in one cup. I only eat one cup. I actually eat very little, but I concentrate it. So one cup of that in the morning is more nutrients that the body can utilize positively than what most people are going to get in a week. It's probably as many as 12 servings of fruits and vegetables just right there in that, based upon how it was prepared. So this idea that we have to sit down to bacon and eggs and toast and milk or coffee or some sugar-coated cereal, it's nonsense. It's the wrong way of approaching it. And then we have to have a big lunch, and then we have to have a big dinner. We're overeating. We have way too many calories, way too many nutrients, and many of those nutrients we don't need. What we need is we need high-quality, energy-producing, tissue-repairing, antioxidant-rich, polyphenol-supreme nutrients going into our body. You'd be much better off just taking a half an avocado, spritzing some lemon or lime juice on it, putting a little Himalayan sea salt and some red pepper and black pepper on it, and scooping that out, putting that onto a little rice cracker and having that as a, what I would call a grazing snack when you get hungry in the afternoon, or some other combination like some hummus or baba ganoush stuffed into a portobello mushroom and that you lightly saute, and you can have that. You want to get your probiotics in. So all that's good, and you really should start thinking about only consuming like maybe a handful of grapes, something easy to digest, quick to digest, that will not spike your blood sugar, and you'll be fine an hour later. So generally 6, 7, 8 o'clock at the latest, you should stop. And that way also it's going to allow you to sleep through the night better. So here's what it's saying, quote, and this was presented at the annual meeting of the Associated Professional Sleep Societies. We know from our sleep loss studies that when you're sleep deprived, it negatively affects weight and metabolism, in part due to late night eating. But now these early findings, which control for sleep, give a more comprehensive picture of the benefits of eating earlier in the day. And that was from the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. Quote, eating later can promote a negative profile of weight, energy, and hormone markers, such as higher glucose, higher insulin, which are implicated in diabetes, and cholesterol and triglycerides, which are linked to cardiovascular problems and other health conditions. So very important, stop eating late at night. If you really have a craving, if you really are in a situation, have popcorn. Popcorn won't raise your metabolic rate, really has no calories, just fiber, that's fine. Or if you feel a satiety not present, then get some ice water with ice on it, drink that with some lemon juice in it, kills your appetite instantly. From Texas A&M University, they found that if you have colitis, if you took pomegranate polyphenolics, you can reduce the inflammation and ulceration in intestinal colitis, and that's good. So that's another good study where pomegranate, once again, is just a superstar. And then from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, published in the Journal of Internal Medicine, four simple things. It's not complicated. Four simple lifestyle choices that can extend your life and quality of life. They studied 64,000 people for this study. And these people had no cancer, cardiovascular disease, and disease when they started. You got to exercise for 150 minutes a week. Okay, that's more or less two and a half hours a week. That's not a lot. Or break it down. Let's just say you exercised for 5 days at a half hour. Now, that's the minimum. I believe that ideally you should be exercising 50 minutes to an hour, 6 days a week. You can divide it into two. 30 minutes aerobic and 30 minutes resistance. That's one of the four factors. Another is, quote, there was an inverse correlation of each of the four health factors, meaning against all-cause mortality, that means death, and increased survival time. What this means is that an inverse ratio is that if you drank, if you smoked, if you ate a garbage diet, if you were sedentary, you had a faster death, faster disease progression rate, and it was reversed. You had slower disease and less death if you had a good, healthy diet. And they're suggesting that this could add 5 years onto men and women's lifestyle. Now, we're not talking about vitamins. We're not talking about superfoods. We're not talking about meditation, stress management, cleaning up your environment. None of the above. We're just talking about simple things could add 5 years onto your lifespan. And they also talked about the smoking, which we're all aware of, and the alcohol consumption. So all those are important. So the two that we can agree with, healthy diet, they suggest, and exercise. So if you have a healthy diet and exercise and you don't smoke or drink, then you can just tag on 5 years to your life, even if you are not taking vitamins or doing the other things like being a vegan. And if you were a vegan, healthy vegan, and de-stressing and taking supplements, you could add another 15 to 20 years onto your life in a healthy way. From Yale University Cancer Center, an analysis of breast cancer data revealed that many small breast cancers have an excellent prognosis of survival because they are inherently slow-growing, as according to Yale Cancer Center experts, and often these cancers will not grow large enough to become significant within a patient's lifetime. And that also means that if you find out you have cancer, there's so many things you can do to mitigate having to do any therapy at all except change your diet and lifestyle. In contrast, they're saying that, quote, large tumors that cause most breast cancer deaths often grow so quickly that they become intrusive before they can be detected by screening mammography. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine this week. And, quote, our analysis explains both how mammography causes overdiagnosis and often why it is not more effective in improving outcomes for our patients. More importantly, it questions some of our fundamental beliefs about the values of early detection. And that was from Dr. Donald Lannan, medical doctor, professor of surgery at Yale School of Medicine, and the lead author of the paper. So what do we know from this? We know that we're being overdiagnosed, and if you're overdiagnosed, you're going to come up with some ductal carcinomas and others that would not be in and of themselves life-threatening. And as a result, you're going to have mastectomies, radiation and chemotherapy, and then you could end up succumbing to the radiation and chemotherapy, both which are proven carcinogenic. So isn't it ironic that a person is screened for breast cancer, they find something that will not either lead to cancer, invasive cancer, malignancy, and then they operate on the woman, removing their breasts, which is unnecessary in most cases and does not work. And then they give the person chemotherapy or radiation, which in itself causes cancer. That's the catch-22 of all this. And finally, magnesium supplements show potential for anti-inflammatory effects. Now, this was a meta-analysis. Meta means many studies. And this was done at Mashhad University of Medical Science and the University of Western Australia. And what we know now, and this study reconfirms, has been confirmed many times, is that dietary supplementation with magnesium can reduce levels of inflammatory biomarkers. There were 11 studies that prove this. It reduces C-reactive protein. That is an established marker for inflammation, especially the heart. What it means in lay language is if you have an elevated C-reactive protein, or CRP, you have chronic inflammation, and you're more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke or even cancer. So magnesium lowers that. Quote from current pharmaceutical design, "The findings suggest that magnesium supplements may have a beneficial role as an adjuvant for the management of low-grade chronic systemic inflammation." So that's just one nutrient. It does over 300 biochemical reactions in the body. It helps maintain normal muscle and nerve function. It keeps your heart rhythm steady. It supports a healthy immune system. It keeps your bones strong. So if you want the superstar of minerals, there's no mineral, zero, no mineral that competes, or even comes close to magnesium. I suggest 1,000 milligrams a day. By the way, it's also needed for blood sugar management and for healthy blood pressure. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. To all the stations for carrying this program, and to all the people listening all over the world, thank you very much. And also, this past week, we began something new. On Tuesday, we inaugurated a live streaming in our new state-of-the-art studios with all of our new monitors and high-resolution cameras. Our Facebook. We're live on Facebook this past week. Fridays I'm taking to work in a different studio because I'm editing, and will for the foreseeable future until hopefully August, our new documentary that I've been out on the road filming for 5 months, and it's a powerful documentary. In fact, my what is called frontline editor, the person that gets the dailies, that's when I shoot and send back to this studio so they can see what I film, they say this is the most powerful documentary I've ever filmed, and it's going to shake the tree of complacency in people to get them to start to be more proactive. That's all I'll say on it. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'm going to be Facebook streaming. Beginning within a week, it'll be on Progressive Radio Network streaming, and a week after that on YouTube. And by the way, I just want to say thank you to the nearly 6 million people who downloaded the documentaries to watch them over YouTube. We did it as a public service, and that's a lot of people watching a documentary. Also, I invited people yesterday. Some of the people didn't hear this announcement because some of the stations preempted normal programming, and understandably so, to offer the Comey hearings. But we broadcasted live anyhow. And I mentioned that right now, the newest documentary I have, Plant Codes, is the most winning documentary in the world thus far this year. And it's finalists in countries I can't get to. The Stockholm International Human Rights Film Festival, the Bali Film Festival, the London Film Festival, Barcelona International, all over the world. So I said, since I have listeners all over the world, if you live in a country where the film festival is a finalist and you want to attend in my place, we'll set all that up, get your ticket, you can go to watch the films and competition, then go to the awards winner afterwards. And 3 people are doing exactly that. In fact, one went to the Houston International Film Festival about a month ago, where Plant Codes won not only best of festival, meaning jury selection. It was the Platinum Remy Award, which is, of all the films shown, it was the best. So we are very appreciative. And this one of our listeners went up on stage and accepted it, and that's very nice. So you want to go to a film festival, we'll post the different places where it's a finalist now. I think we're finalists in 20 different places. I think we've won 37 or 38 thus far since January. So it's fun if you've never been to one. You meet a lot of interesting people. In any case, a week from Sunday, I'm going to do a webinar. I had so many people contact me after the last webinar about reversing the aging process naturally, but that was about the aging process in our cells and our heart and our muscles and skin and eyes. And it was well received, very positive feedback, 3 hours long. But people now have been coming out of the woodworks. My mom has Alzheimer's, my dad's getting their memory loss. What do you do? What do you do? So I'm going to do a new webinar, not this Sunday, but a Sunday the week from this Sunday, 7 p.m. There'll be a film shown that I finished on preventing and reversing brain aging naturally. And then I will do a 2-hour webinar where I'll be giving protocols for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, depression, anxiety, memory loss, dementia, the things that millions, tens of millions of people suffer from. Because to do it on a radio program, it would not do justice to do it in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. It's going to take 3 hours. So go to GaryNall.com and you'll see webinar on reversing brain aging naturally. And hopefully you can use that on the people in your own life. And by the way, everything in those protocols, I personally do. That's how you prevent your brain from aging. So this idea that we're not going to do anything until there's a crisis or disaster, then we'll seek some help, that's not the best approach. The best approach is if you can and it's reasonable and responsible, do it daily. Now, earlier this week, we had on our program Kenny. And Kenny had reversed completely multiple sclerosis. He had had it, 2 different sets of tests by 2 different board-certified neurologists showed that with MRIs and with other blood markers that he had multiple sclerosis and he couldn't walk, couldn't stand up on his own. And 16 months later, after joining a brain-reversing, brain disease-reversing protocol health support group, he and a lot of other people were completely well. Today, 10 years later, he's completely well. And so each week I'm going to bring on someone else that had a medically irreversible condition that reversed it to tell their story, uncoached, unrehearsed, whatever they have to say is what they're going to say, to hopefully inspire other people not to give up on yourself or loved ones who are going down that slippery slope where nothing can help them. So just go to GaryNall.com and click on. Every one of my webinars over the last 4 months have been packed. In fact, thousands couldn't get on. Go early, or I promise you, if you wait, you won't be able to get on because there's only so much bandwidth we can use, and then you can't see it. By the way, I was amazed. We get what is called a Google Analytics, and one of our new webmasters said, you should take a look at this. Here's how many people watched you and listened to you over Facebook. It's in the thousands upon thousands. In fact, more people watch that on Facebook than listen to one of our sister stations entirely in 24-hour period. So we're reaching a lot of people. And guess what the age? We just got this. This is a brand new analytic I just got. The average age of people listening to this radio show over Facebook is between 24 and 36-year-old male. And about 45% are female, about 55% are male, both in the same age group, educated and interested in social issues. So that's good. Getting messages out to young people who can then use them in their own life. I think it's important what is happening in England. We have had a super hawk. We had a super neoliberal conservative running the British government. We've had several, David Cameron, before her. So, here is a man who may be in a position to eventually become prime minister. And boy, would that be good for the common person and to stop war and nation building and regime change, Jeremy Corbyn. Here's what he had to say. Now, mind you, Jeremy said this before the invasion of Iraq on February 15, 2003. This is Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you to every single person that's here today in the biggest ever political demonstration in the history of this country. And today, there are 600 and more demonstrations in cities all around the world. Every country, every continent, everybody in the world has a chance today to say no, absolutely no, to war on Iraq. Well, surely the message today in London, in Glasgow, and ordinary people on the streets of this country is this. Why are we spending £3.5 billion on a war that nobody wants? When there is an AIDS pandemic sweeping Africa, when a quarter of the world's children die in poverty and starvation, and we say there isn't money sufficient for our own public services. Thousands more deaths in Iraq will not make things right. It will set off a spiral of conflict, of hate, of misery, of desperation that will fuel the wars, the conflict, the terrorism, the depression, and the misery of future generations. Our message today here in London, a million and more strong, is this. We want to live in a world free from war. The way to free us from the scourge of war is to free ourselves from the scourge of injustice, of poverty, and the misery that's associated with that. This movement is giving that message to the British government. Stop now or pay a political price. Thank you very much.
All right. The government did not stop. Tony Blair, the little lapdog of George Bush, engaged in deception and fraud, and we now know that and have proof of it. They had an awareness that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, but went ahead anyhow, and that's what we've been faced with since, all this carnage. So let us hope that with Prime Minister May's resounding thumping yesterday in the British elections, the snap elections, and now the rise of the Corbyn Liberal group, the Labour Party, that he will be in a position to stop further money being spent in the military-industrial campaigns in the Middle East, meddling in the Middle East. And by the way, it was Great Britain under its last three prime ministers that supported Saudi Arabia, supported Kuwait, supported Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and supported Israel. So maybe there'll be a new day. I want to share a few things before we go to our guest. I want to share what's happening with the environment by giving you just one piece of the puzzle. Because we do not see a disaster, because a disaster has not unfolded in our vision field, doesn't mean it's not relevant. It doesn't impact us. It does. This is from Andrei Vetchek of Counterpunch. Quote, how destructive can man get? How ruthless in his quest to secure maximum profit, even as he endangers the very survival of our planet. The tropical forest of Borneo in Malaysia, the third largest island in the world, have almost totally disappeared, gone. Coal mines are savagely scarring the hills, the rivers are polluted, the countless species are endangered, or almost completely extinct. It is all a terrible sight, whether you see it from the air or when driving or walking, through the devastation that is taking place on the ground. The soil is black. It is often saturated with chemicals. Dead stubs of trees are accusatively pointing towards the sky. Many wonderful creatures, big and small, who used to proudly inhabit this tropical paradise are now hiding in the depth of what remains of one of the largest tropical jungles on Earth. Engines are instantly roaring everywhere. Huge equipment is continually cutting through something pure or digging and finally transporting what has already been extracted, killed, or taken down mercilessly. Mrs. Mira Lubis, senior lecturer at the Tanjungpura University in the Western Province, summarizes the situation honestly but brutally. Quote, "I think we, the people of Borneo, have lost our sovereignty over our own space and resources under the pressure of global capitalism. Apparently, we just became poor despite all the wealth that we have." And then he talks about how one morning when he was looking out his hotel window in the city of East Kalimantan, he spotted an enormous coal barge. It was sitting right in front of him, stubbornly under the bridge, one of only two bridges connecting two shores to a city of 850,000. The barge was too big to move, as the current appeared to be too strong, and one boat was behind it pushing, another was trying to pull it, to no avail. Why? It was overloaded with coal. And that's what happens. But he wanted to see the coal mines, but all the coal mines on the island are off limits. No reporters, no visitors can see them. And so he knew that he had to get to the coal mines in order to see how much of a contribution they were playing in the destruction of the island. And he was finally able to get up there, and he saw, and it just overwhelmed him. Now, that's the message that he brings back of how little land the average person has, of how the land they do have can't grow much because it's so polluted, how the water's polluted, how the palm oil, quote, "the palm oil plantation is good for the environment around here." No. But it's destroying the habitat of the orangutans and all other species, and they can make a lot of money off of it, and that's what's happening. So here's the piece of the puzzle. Here you have an island that very few Americans know about or will have ever visited, and yet what we do allowing multinational corporations, and they're not political, they're not left or right, conservative, Republican, that's irrelevant to them. It's profitable. It's profitable for these major mega corporations to extract the natural resources, and what consequence it has to the rivers, the streams, the fertility of the earth, the pollution in the sky is irrelevant to them. What it does to shortening the lifespan of the people working in these torture conditions is still irrelevant to them. It's only relevant to their corporations and to increasing their margin of profit of taking something at so little expense to extract and so little expense to give to China or India or some country to manufacture and then bring it into the United States or Western Europe to sell. And don't be deceived by the brand names or the celebrity endorsements. At the end of almost all that is produced, there is some form of indentured or slave labor. So the question I have to ask is this, and it's simply a question, not a statement, nor a rhetorical. When you buy something, when you eat something, when you go into a restaurant, when you put on a shirt, a dress, a coat, buy a car, a computer, a watch, a cell phone, do you ever take a moment and go up on the internet and search for the sources of the materials that went into that product? You can do that. It's not that difficult. And see, where did my watch come from? Where did the components in this computer come from? And if you did, good for you, because that's the first step you should take, being an informed and conscious consumer, conscious of the choices you make. If you didn't, if you just take it for granted that everything's cool because, hey, you spent a lot of money on this, so everybody must have made money all the way around, that's not true. That's a gross assumption. It's only when we become resensitized with empathy and understanding of the suffering that nature, animals, sentient beings, and humans have had to bear in order for us to have an ever-growing consumer society that maybe austerity, taking on even some percentage of the ascetic life, like of a Saint Francis of Assisi or a Gandhi, that we don't need all this materialism, we don't need to live in gated communities, we don't need the latest gadget in order to have a quality of life and help in our own way, help take one tiny step in saving the planet. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. We are now going to go to, we're going to go to San Diego. We're standing by as Professor Gershon Shafir. He is professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of California, San Diego, and he served as the director of its Institute for International Comparative and Area Studies. He is the founding director of its Human Rights Program. He's a former president of the Israeli Studies Association. Professor Shafir received his undergraduate degree in political science, economics, and sociology at Tel Aviv University in Israel, and later his master's from UCLA and his PhD in sociology from the University of Berkeley, California, Berkeley. And he's the author of, or editor of, 10 books, among them Being Israeli, The Dynamics of Multiple Citizenship, which won the Middle Eastern Studies Association Albert Hurani Award. And his most recent book is A Half Century of Occupation, Israel, Palestine, and the World's Most Intractable Conflict, which marks the 50th year anniversary since the Six-Day War in 1967 that largely defined modern Israel today. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Gary.
We are now at the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, what Arabs call the Nakba, between Israel and Egypt and other Arab states. And this was a huge turning point that has largely defined all the interactions and conflicts between Israel and the Palestinians and its neighbors ever since. In addition to the Sinai, what is known today as Gaza, also add in the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank, came under Israeli control. But before we go into the larger and deeper issues of the occupation and the expansion of Israeli settlements, there is controversy over who initiated the Six-Day War. There were earlier wars, the War of Independence in 1948 and again in 1956. So looking back upon 1967, when Israel sorely defeated its Arab neighbors, Egypt and Jordan, what do we know now today about who the original aggressor was for the Six-Day War? The forum is yours.
Well, thank you. Well, there is no disagreement today. The first shot was fired by Israel on June 5th of 1967 when its forces invaded the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. And yet, the United Nations Security Council never condemned Israel for aggression, notwithstanding the demands of the Soviet bloc that supported Egypt and Syria. And the reason is simple. Egypt has amassed its troops, and so did Syria, along the Israeli border. They have removed the United Nations inspectors that have been placed there after the 1956 war, and they closed off the Straits of Tehran to Israeli shipping to the Red Sea. So in many ways, the Egyptians have committed an act of that would amount, I guess, to a casus belli that would put Israel in a position where it could argue that its military action was defensive rather than aggressive, and the international community agreed with that.
Throughout the American media, throughout all of the political parties and politicians, among the pro-Israeli American supporters, the words occupation or apartheid are anathema. In fact, to even speak in defining Israel's relationship and actions against Palestine as an occupation is to almost be labeled an anti-Semite. And you refer to this as occupation denialism, and I'd like you to speak about this denialism in some depth, because if we can look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict objectively for what it is, and if we cannot be clear with our definitions, then it seems less possible that there can ever be a real solution. And also give some clear examples of how this occupational denialism serves the larger interests of both Israeli's government and American and its allies' interests in the Middle East.
Indeed, when I lecture and I mention the word occupation, to an American Jewish audience, a pall falls over the room, and the howls of dissent. Not just Jewish audiences, both the Republican and Democratic parties in their platforms before the elections last year argued that the term omitted the term. But I'm suggesting that this is not just a matter of silence, of Israel censoring itself, or secrecy, of concealing information from others, but it's a matter of subversion, the corruption of the tools. So a denial wouldn't be just a lack of knowledge, but rather a complex form of knowledge, and also a pact of ignorance. How so? I'm borrowing the term from the environmentalists who use the concept of denialism to describe how truth is being subverted. Denialism would be a rhetorical tactic to give the appearance of argument or legitimate debate when in actuality there is none. Because the international community agrees this is the term that is being used. And furthermore, the Israeli government itself relies on international humanitarian law, that is the law of belligerent occupation, when it argues its cases in front of the Israeli Supreme Court. So what it denies with one hand, it acknowledges with the other one. And occupations are even by many smaller and bigger denials, but ultimately they are the story of a people denied, the Palestinian people. And in my new book, I describe how the Shamgar Doctrine, which I name after Meir Shamgar, who was the military general advocate during the 1967 war, and later a member, a justice, and the president of the Israeli Supreme Court in the 1980s, you know, justified and legalized this legal denialism, which writes Palestinians out of the history of their own country. The occupations are temporary by definition. One is not allowed, the occupying country is not allowed to transfer the sovereignty over the territory that it occupied to itself. That means that all occupations have to remain temporary. But according to Shamgar, and at least here let me give you one brief quote, pending an alternative political or military solution, this system of government could, from the legal point of view, continue indefinitely. In other words, he defines occupation as permanently temporary. You could say the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories is temporary and will always remain temporary. Now, many decisions of the Israeli Supreme Court are based on the premise that this occupation itself is temporary. For example, that the settlements that have been constructed under international humanitarian law or the law of belligerent occupation remain temporary, since they cannot continue past the end of the occupation. Now, as long this very illusion of the occupation's temporariness plays a crucial role in perpetuating it. As long as the occupation remains temporary, it can be viewed as a historical incident, and the occupied Palestinians can be considered as laying outside the boundaries of the State of Israel. And because this temporal divide is imposed on a geographical one, Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank live, by the way, under one set of rules, Israeli settlers in them under other one, but also within Israel, there is a civil legal system. Given this temporal and geographical divide, the occupation remains invisible to most Israelis, even after half a century of occupation. And splitting time and space in this way, permanent on one side of the Green Line and temporary on the other one, removes the need, even the possibility, to feel responsible for the circumstances under which occupied Palestinians live. So temporariness at once constitutes Palestinians as the subjects of Israeli colonial rule while denying that such colonialism exists. Temporariness also allows Israel to bracket their participation in the occupation, and it permits the continued domestic and widespread international acceptance of Israel as a democratic state.
A little further on that, because the United Nations Security Council and the International Court of Justice and Israel's own high court and almost every nation consider the lands occupied in 1967 as legally separate from Israel, and there's supposed to be laws to frame the distinction. However, these laws are constantly violated without any international condemnation. And then, could you help us understand the strategy behind the further creep of settlements involving tens of thousands of settlers along in East Jerusalem and the West Bank? And I feel most listeners and perhaps most Americans view settlements as a more recent development, largely being done by a variety of Jewish groups and organizations, and that are only peripherally sanctioned by the central government. However, the strategy of a settlement program by using various religious citizens groups to gradually encroach and take over the land from Palestinians has been going on for decades. And it's true that the policy of settlements goes back before the 1967 Six-Day War, and that the Green Line has now been essentially erased. And then how is this settlement movement actually part of a national plan to colonize Palestinians and Arabs that goes back several decades even before that? Could you address these, please, in your final statement?
Yes. First of all, the term settlement itself is, I would suggest, a useless term. In English, when we use the term settlement, we usually refer to something having been resolved. In this case, the settlement creates the problem rather than resolving it. It's an anodyne term without any context, political or historical. So I prefer to use the term colonization. By the way, this is the term that the French use when they refer to Israeli settlements. And if you use the term colonization or settler colonialism, we put the Israeli practice into a context in which will help us understand the bitterness and the intransigence that surrounds it. Furthermore, the collective non-settlement is also misleading. There isn't a single architecture of settlements. There isn't a single settlement movement. In fact, I would suggest that Israelis are like the Inuit, who distinguish between different types of snow. Just as many types of snow there are for the Inuit, there are as many types of settlements for the Israelis. So there have been initially a military frontier, then there is a messianic or religious frontier, there is a secular suburban frontier, there is a religious suburban or Haredi, actually ultra-Orthodox. So we have two different religious settlements, frontiers. There are outposts that are not recognized even by Israel itself as a legitimate form of settlement. Then there are ring towns around Jerusalem itself. So all of these are differ a great deal from one another. But probably the main point to draw from that is that this complexity, this multi-sidedness, the fact that so many different groups have been put in the service of colonization indicates that this settlement project itself is riven with contradictions from within, which weaken it. And let me give you, and there is an element of denial or denialism in regard to the depth of the hold that the settlements provide Israel with. Let me give you a couple of numbers. The original Likud settlement plan from 1981 projected that by 2010, there would be 1.3 million Jews living alongside 1.8 million Arabs in the West Bank. In fact, in the mid-2016, among the close to 3 million West Bank Palestinians, there were 405,000 Israeli settlers and about another 200,000 in the Jerusalem ring towns. But at least in the West Bank, Jewish settlers make up only 13.8% of the region's population. So Palestinians continue maintaining a crushing demographic dominance. Even more striking, the annual growth rate of the settler population shows a long-term decline from about 10% in the 1990s to 3.9% in 2016. And most damningly, almost 80% of the Jewish population increase in the West Bank comes from natural growth. Because the reason is that Israelis from across the Green Line, that is from within the 1948 boundaries of Israel, are staying away, notwithstanding the severe housing crisis they suffer from. So the geographic and economic impact of Israeli colonization also remains limited. The built-up area of the colonies takes up 2% of the West Bank. Most settlers commute to Israel for their employment. It is clear, though, there is the exception of the ring settlements of East Jerusalem, and there are also three settlement blocks, secular settlement blocks and ultra-Orthodox settlement blocks that hug the Green Line from its eastern side. But discussions for a territorial exchange of about 4% of Israel's territory, for 4% of an equivalent percentage in the West Bank, would be in an advanced stage during the Olmert-Abbas negotiations in 2008. And the 4% territorial exchange would allow Israel to retain these blocks as part of the territorial partition, which would create a state of Palestine. According to my calculation, about 27,000 settler households, these are the religious nationalist ones, including the town of Ariel, which sticks like a finger into the West Bank and therefore cannot be accommodated by the Palestinians, would enable a 4% territorial exchange. So to conclude, I would say that the settlement project has not created the conditions for the annexation of the West Bank to Israel, nor made it inevitable, because the demographic and geographical footprint of the settlements is too small. And therefore, on the 50th anniversary of the occupation, the settlement project remains partial, incomplete, and the future is yet to be written.
Well, we will have to continue this discussion on solutions. I'm sure you have many. Professor Gershon Shafir, thank you very much for being with us, and his book is A Half Century of Occupation. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.